There is a story in Kannada, local language, told among the rural folks of a poor woman, and she's a young widow, so to say, and she has children, and she struggles to make money to taking care of the family. And very pious, God-fearing lady in some remote corner of the country. It seems a wealthy gentleman who was traveling across the country, going to different places and seeing the beauty of the country. Due to the force of the circumstance, he had to stay in that village, and he was not dressed like a wealthy person. He was dressed like an ordinary man, and judging by appearance, most of the people in the village shunned him away, and they would not extend hospitality to him or give him shelter and food. And probably in those days there was all these mobile apps and things to book a room and then go and stay. So they had to rely upon the good nature and philanthropic nature of the people of the country. Anand knows it very well. Anand, who has traveled across the country, keeps saying of this beauty of our country. And so this lady, nevertheless, opens the door with a beaming smile and welcomes him and gives him shelter, food, whatever little that she could, food, and serves him in the true spirit of Indian, ancient Indian culture, which is Atithi Devo Bhava. That is, the guest who comes to house, he is God itself. So after a couple of days of accepting the hospitality, the gentleman is very moved by the pious lady and their children, and how well she is bringing up those children who don't have much money, but who are full of hidden treasures, invisible treasures, not physical wealth, but they are saturated with moral and spiritual wealth, unlettered yet wise. So he is moved by compassion towards them, and he decides that he will keep this bag of gold coins in a corner of that room and quietly go away the next day morning before the family wakes up. And the family will, during the day while cleaning the room, find the gold coin, and it will really be helpful to them for the education of the children, for their clothing, for the food and the security of the family. And he goes away the next day morning, and the children are cleaning the room, helping the mother in the household chores. And they find in the corner the pouch of gold coins. They don't touch it. They bring the mother to it. The mother says, "This corner is quarantined to us. We are not going to go to that corner ever again. All other parts of the room, we will keep it as we were keeping it earlier, clean and neat and ready, and use it. But that corner is not ours. We'll leave it. We'll forget about it." So this happens, and 2-3 months later, the wealthy gentleman comes to the house again, expecting a bigger house with more thatched roof, better roof, and children wearing better clothes and happy and all that. Not that they were not happy before, but wealthy people have this idea. I mean, based on our understanding of life, we decide what is right and wrong, right? And our philanthropy also is colored in that manner. So he thought that he's doing good to them, and comes and sees, to much of his surprise and shock, It's all the same house, still the same people, same kind of old torn clothes, same beaming smile. And then he comes, and then the mother immediately recognizes him and says that, "You have left your object there. Please take it and go." And then in Kannada, the moral of the story is mentioned as adharmadim bandudam valle embude dharma. That means whatever we receive through adharma, in the sense what unrighteous means, rejecting that kind of thinking, that kind of behavior, that course of action, rejection of that course of action is dharma. So this kind of sets the keynote, so to say, for our discussion about wealth and right livelihood, that, you know, gathering wealth is not an end in itself. And to use the typical Gandhian binary of ends and means, the means that we employ to gain something is in a way the end itself, and the means and the ends have the same relationship as the seed and the tree. If we use unrighteous, violent, unjust means, even so to say, to achieve just ends, it is impossible to do that. Nature doesn't allow it. The means that we use is the end in itself. Gandhi, though he spoke of these binaries between ends and means, it was a unitary aspect for him. Means are as pure, should be as pure as the end itself. Applying it to our subject today, we all need to earn, as we have certain legitimate desires to be fulfilled. And Krishna says in the Gita that, "I am desire regulated by moral fitness." Desire gets much bad press, so to say, where we say, destroy desire, remove desire. That's one kind of desire that is being spoken of. But Krishna says, dharma avirodha kama, I am that. That is, when there are desires which are legitimate, such as me being a householder, I have the duty to take care of my children, take care of my family, my wife, my parents, and generate the means of becoming existence, like we were reading Schumacher some time ago, right? Means for becoming existence. Those are legitimate desires. Now, to fulfill those legitimate desires, which are obligations to one's true self and obligation to the family that I have taken upon myself as a responsibility, and by the mere fact of being born in this society and this country, there are certain obligations that I have. In order to fulfill that, all these obligations are incumbent upon all of us. And to fulfill them, I need the means to fulfill them. And on the material plane, it is money or wealth that is the means of fulfilling, satisfying, and doing our duties, fulfilling the desires, legitimate desires. So in the Purusharthas, kama and artha are these two natural, unavoidable facts of human existence. All beings having desires, and all beings having the necessity to fulfill those desires through some means, livelihood. The tragedy of the world is that desires and means to satisfy the desires, have become the end all and be all. But the ancient perspective of life was that, yes, you have desires, legitimate as well as illegitimate, and fulfillment of legitimate ones requires means of fulfilling it, artha, kama and artha. But these two must be always circumscribed within a certain strict framework called righteousness, dharma, If that framework is not there, then man tends to become more and more animal, and his life becomes more and more conflicting and not peaceful, and more suffering to himself. And by his very thinking and action, he becomes a source of sorrow, a sort of a cancer for the society to which he is deeply interconnected. So, but on the other hand, if legitimate desires and the means to fulfill them are prescribed and restricted within the framework of righteousness, then instead of going down, he becomes elevated, he becomes sublime, his work becomes worship, and his wealth, instead of becoming a source of degeneration and debasement for himself, gets alchemically transmuted to a higher goal and a higher wealth, right? That is what leads to the other purusharta, the fourth purusharta of moksha. Moksha not certainly of individual self, as has been repeatedly explained elsewhere, in many places. Man does his duty, or that which is due to humanity, not for his pleasures or not for his own progress, but because he is deeply indebted to nature with N capitals. Nature with N capitals is all sentient beings with whom man has a kinship. And is there any being with whom man does not have kinship? Man is deeply connected with all beings, all sentient beings. He owes them a lot. Just as they have supplemented to him so much on the plane of physical body, on the plane of mind, on the plane of morality, on the plane of emotional welfare and being, on the plane of spirituality. So this paraspara bhava, or the wheel of reciprocity, must be kept revolving by man. That is righteousness. If he keeps it revolving through his rightful means, fulfillment of his rightful desires, and prescribed within the framework which has been defined, then it produces the greatest wealth for him, even on the physical plane. We are not talking of merely spiritual wealth. Spiritual wealth also, as well as material wealth, prosperity, and his bank account will be overflowing, right? So spirituality and materiality are not opposites. They are complementary, in the sense that as long as we determine in the hierarchy what is above and what is below correctly, materiality has its place and it fulfills its purpose. Wadiyaji says in one of his articles that we are all trustees of our possessions. That's the name of the article, by the way. We are trustees of our possessions. He says there are three categories of people in general when you analyze the society. One are those, by and large, the majority today, 500 years ago, 1000 years ago, maybe 1000 years hence also. The majority are those who have decided that material wealth, gaining of it, securing of it, is the end all and be all of life. So for them, spirituality, religious sentiments are more of a secondary thing. First, let me get these things right. Once this is done, if time allows, and if the God that they worship, the God of money, if that great tribal God allows you, then you can practice some virtues. But not otherwise. First, you satisfy the hunger of the tribal God that we are worshipping. That's the first category of people, right? And they don't, by and large, they have no qualms about what means they use to generate that wealth, right? I'm reminded here of a conversation between Sebastian and Alonso in Tempest, where, you know, one of them is, I think, Sebastian, or one person, let's say some person, he is desirous of becoming the Duke of Milan, and the actual Duke is asleep in a forest, and he is having this conversation between himself and the other person to see whether he should draw his sword and kill the Duke so that he is the next in line and he obtains the kingdom. And then the other person asks him, but what about your conscience? Does your conscience allow you to do it? And the response, nobody can beat Shakespeare in his verse, so we'll have to read him. Very short response. I will read this. So Sebastian asks Antonio, but for your conscience, what about your conscience? And then Antonio is responding, aye, sir, where lies that? Where lies that? Where is conscience? Where lies that? If it were a kaib, it would put me to slipper. Means if conscience were at least a blister on my feet, it would compel me to at least wear a slipper, right? If it were a kaib, it would put me to my slipper, but I feel not this deity in my bosom. I don't feel this deity in my bosom at all. 20 consciences that stand twixt me and Milan, candid be they and melt ere they molest. Means, forget about one conscience. Even if 20 consciences were to stand between me and Milan, me becoming the Duke of Milan, like the candy melts before the sun, they would all melt before they trouble me, before they molest me. So, conscience would melt and go away rather than they trouble me. Our conscience will sometimes trouble us. So, that is the first category of people who say that this is what it is. This is reality. I mean, I was born some time ago. I don't know. I don't know why I'm born here. I have some opportunities and many disadvantages. And whatever opportunities I have to invest, reinvest, and make the best of it every moment of my life to enlarge my wealth, expand my wealth, expand my influence, my power, my fame. That's the goal of life. That's what we are here for. All other things, ecological concern, it will come later. I mean, it's okay. Or if I'm...
Social impact.
Social impact is okay. It's all right. As long as... See, social impact is okay because I'm not being troubled and my wealth will safeguard my children. So why bother about it? If your conscience, unlike Antonio's, really molests you inside, then you have religion to come into play, where religion, whether whatever, Hinduism or Christianity, Islam, whatever they may be, there they will allow you to make a compromise between your morality, the deity in the bosom, conscience, and what you ought to do. They make a compromise. Formal religions are always a moral compromise. So their religion steps in and says, you do this, you do that, and you compensate using these means, and therefore you will be able to offset, so to say, the demerit, if at all demerit bothers you. Right? So that's one category of people. The second category of people, he says, are those who are second category are those who have decided that materiality and spirituality are opposites, and I want spirituality, therefore I will deny materiality, in sense that they think that spirituality consists in being, or so to say, outward rejection of wealth. They are also materialists in one way, because they don't recognize the inner aspects of man at all. They think physical rejection of wealth or comfortable clothing or a shelter or a family which provides such great emotional support, rejection of that outwardly is obtaining of spirituality, right? So that's another kind of people, second category of people who do the mistakes. And Wadiaji says these kind of people begin with the sentiment to become a sannyasi, finally become a bhikshuka who is a tax on the society and a general nuisance. In general, a nuisance and a tax on the society, because they don't contribute to the society. And contribution need not be contribution to the GDP, right? It's not necessary that person needs to contribute to the GDP. That's not the only contribution. Doing the duties of our life is the greatest contribution in the station of life that we are in, right? Everybody need not go and do physical philanthropy, or need not go and become teachers of the masses. But by being where we are and doing what we ought to do in the framework of righteousness, we are making the world our debtors. Right? So that's the second class of people. The third class of people, he says, are those who are somewhat like beyond both of these classes, who are a small minority all the time, because they have discerned the inner real versus the outer reflective, and they feel that it is not merely outward rejection of wealth and physical comforts, nor is it a drowning in them and enjoyment and self-identification with them. Both these schools of thought they have rejected and found the apex of the triangle, who say that all these things are given to me, so to say, and belong to me as much as I am a trustee of them. What is the difference between an owner and a trustee? It's somewhat easy to understand. If I am sent on an official trip by my office and I am given some money for my official expenses, I expend that money and come back and present an account of it to my management. The people who gave the money, I am accountable for it, because I give an account of it at the end of the trip. Auto, so many rupees. Food, 3 times a day. This is the bill. This is the bill number, date of the bill, amount. These are all the official expenses. This is the account. So that money, I don't own it. I am a trustee of that money, right? Ownership would be that I can do whatever I want without asking anybody. If you really come to think of it, there is not an atom in our body to which we can really say we are owners. Nevertheless, by and large, ownership and trusteeship, this is the difference, right? Owner means I have complete autonomy. Trustee means I am bound by certain conditions. And Gandhiji, who was probably the greatest exponent of trusteeship, he derived his idea of trusteeship from two major sources where he spoke of Ramayana incident, where Rama has decided to go to Vanavas, and Bharata, who is compelled to become the king, takes the footwear of Rama, keeps it on his head, and says that till you come back, I will rule Ayodhya in your stead, that is, in as a representative of you, I will rule it. And he installs the footwear on the simhasana, on the, what do they call, on the throne, and he stays in the outskirts of the Ayodhya in a hut, living like Rama, and he rules the kingdom, right? So he was a trustee. He was not an owner. He was not a king. He was a trustee. And the other Upanishadic source that Gandhiji traces his idea of trusteeship to is the first verse in the Ishavasi Upanishad, which says, Ishavasyam idam sarvam, yatkincha jagatyam jagat, tena tyaktena bunjita, magrida kasya svidhanam. When this whole world is pervaded by the self, spirit, the Lord, and the whole world is that, Gandhi says, what is it that you can legitimately call as yours? When all belongs to the Lord, it is only a portion that is assigned to you in terms of your body, in terms of the length of the body, that is the time that we have here, and the spiritual faculties, mental faculties, psychic, emotional, and physical faculties. There are deities who are all various small branches of that great Lord of light. They're all functioning to fulfill the purpose of the great Lord. And the opportunities that we have in life, the wealth that we have inherited from our family, the mental and physical faculties which allow us to generate wealth for oneself and family. When none of this belongs to you, when you yourself, like Buddha says, is a beggar going about in borrowed robes. Attahi attano natti kuto putto kuto dhanam. When you yourself don't belong to yourself, how do you call your son as yours and all the wealth as yours? You are a beggar. That's the idea with which the whole life was seen. And this has a deep impact upon the idea of the work itself, right? The work that we do. Like we were discussing some time ago, our concept of livelihood, making a livelihood, is the employee and the employer are always at loggerheads. They are two opposing forces. Each one has to be more cunning and cleverer than the other to exploit the most and give back the least, if at all he can give. So employee's attitude is that I should do as less amount of work and take as much of compensation as possible. Employer attitude is I should give as less as possible, and if possible, automate, mechanize that work and remove the human element and make as much as profit as possible without any other concern, not only for the employee, but other social concerns, other impact of society, other impact on the ecology. All those are not, these are all secondary things. Doesn't matter. First make wealth, right? So this is the view of the modern relationship between the capital and labor, so to say. And interestingly, if you look at the terminologies that we use to between employee and employer, my salary is not merely called as salary. It is very sophisticatedly called as cost to the company. Cost to the company, CTC, right? I am not a human being working. I am a cost, and if they can reduce the cost or do away with the cost, well and good for them. And when he pays me the money, I call it a compensation. What's your compensation, Nantakelti, for salary, right? It's a compensation, as if I have given up so many things in life and lost something valuable, like some tragedy happens and the government gives compensation, right? Like that, if I work, the dreadful work, which I go and with a lot of mental agony, I go through the work, I am compensated with money, right? Look at this relationship and contrast this. Contrast this with what Schumacher says as the Buddhist Buddhist economics, where work had at least three principal functions, right? On the lowest physical plane, work of a person, whatever state that he may be in, wherever he may be employed, is to generate goods and services for the making of a becoming existence. That is at the physical level. But the work doesn't stop there, because the Buddhist has recognized that man has other aspects which needs to be worked, which needs to be employed, which needs to be put to use for the greatest good of the society, right? So while physically it is goods and services, on the mental plane comes the second aspect of work, which is it allows man to overcome his egocentredness by giving him an opportunity to engage in a common work with others. We go to office, we find people of very different mindsets. We are compelled by work, so to say, if we take it in the right spirit, to engage with them, to let go of our ideas, let go of our likes and dislikes, suppress our the poisonous personal likes and dislikes, broaden our mind to other perspectives, learn how to work with them and deal with them, and have a good relationship with all of them. All these are opportunities given to man to overcome his egocentredness. That's the second aspect, mental aspect of work. The moral spiritual aspect, he says, thirdly, is it allows him to, it gives him the opportunity to exercise his faculties and powers for the highest good. We use our mind, we use our imagination, we use our logic, we use our ability to think, to conceptualize, all on the mental plane, and to plan and to execute it and physically work. All these, when taken in the right spirit of livelihood, are opportunities given for the ego, for the soul, to exercise its faculties for the highest good. Why does it need to do that? Why do we need to do that? Because artha, wealth, is needed to satisfy legitimate desires, dharma avirodha kama, within the framework of righteousness for the welfare of others. The grand view of economics, livelihood, sociology, rooted in the spiritual understanding of man as a divine being, undergoing a human phase of existence. We are all divine beings undergoing a human phase of existence, repeatedly coming again and again to multiple bodies, working, discharging our duties, and with our ideas of right and wrong, making causes, learning from those causes, effects of those causes, experiencing them. In this whole journey of human existence, livelihood, right livelihood, or as Buddha calls it, samyak ajiva, played a very important role, right? So this is one thing. And let's see what else we can look at. In the Indian tradition, there was always a difference made between wealth which ennobles, which purifies, and which elevates man, which obviously, it goes without saying, had to be generated through righteous means, and as a contrast, wealth which is generated through, you know, questionable means, which may be very large, very huge amounts, but which is always a pot of poison that we have filled drop by drop, and which we and our subsequent generation as well as we coming in the subsequent lives, have to drink the bitter gall and go through the troubles of that wealth that we have generated through unrighteous means. Somewhere it is said, I think Vadiyaji says that, this was what was symbolized as the pure, divine and pious goddess Lakshmi versus the evil Yaksha,
Kubera.
Pure and residing in the heart of Vishnu, the great Lord, is Lakshmi. Ideally typifying spiritual wealth, buddhi, spiritual discernment. But in human existence, also wealth which has been generated through rightful means. Without letting go of the rightful path of virtues and ethics, right? She is Lakshmi. She ennobles you. She grants you all the wishes. And she doesn't come because we do Lakshmi Puja in the evening of whatever, whenever in Dakshinayana we do that, but lead our life like Kuberas. That's not the way it happens if you come to think of it, right? And Kubera's symbology, I mean, iconography is very interesting. He's a large pot belly and his color is the color of lotus colored, probably dark red in color. And he has three legs, always limping. Limping because one is it's not a straightforward path. And secondly, limping because you have not generated it through walking the right path. And limping because limp means you will fall, you are injured, and that wealth will always lead you to injury. Probably all this is symbolized in that. And he has eight teeth. Eight, probably, I was remembering the eight dire miseries. Forsake forevermore, as Voice of the Silence says. The eight dire miseries. So that wealth becomes a poison. Wealth generated out of regard for others and wealth generated through wrongful means. So if man understands that our actions are sure to produce results which are unavoidable, irrespective of what religious beliefs or non-religious beliefs that you have. And it's a common sense, natural sense of justice if we just let our natural sense of justice guide us rather than the beliefs that we have, you will see that we cannot generate anything for us or for our family through wrongful means and not expect the backlash from it, which comes either as disease or as painful life circumstances, which we will really repent. We may not see the direct cause of it because we are not looking into the plane of causes and effects. We are only looking at its shadow expressions on the physical plane. Or it may strike us as peculiar diseases which were unheard of in the family or which was unexpected. Or the circumstances of life may happen in such a way that it will bring about disharmony and sort of a conflicting environment within the family, where the mental peace that the earlier generations had is vitiated. The whole mental atmosphere is stifling. Many things can happen. The karmic backlash will come to the ego in many manners. It may come on the plane of body and circumstance, on the plane of mind and our feelings, or on the plane of emotions, or on the worst thing, on the plane of morality, where you are, as the Jain says, darshana avaraniya karma. You do certain acts, certain actions, which will mask off your very moral sense. Nothing more calamitous than that. Cutting off your hand, leg, or losing money is nothing. In a few years, anyway, it's going to go. That's not the big deal. But if your moral sense is emasculated, nothing worse can happen to that, because that is a more permanent damage which will lead him repeatedly, life after life, to disasters followed by disasters. So as one of the saint in India was telling, that Indians have been asked throughout the millennium by their spiritual instructors in all parts of the world, in all parts of the country, not to generate wealth. In the sense, not that they need to generate wealth, not that they need to have large mansions and great locomotive powers and great bank balance. It is not that we have been asked to do. We have been asked to only maintain our dharma, righteousness. Hold on to righteousness. All other, even material welfare, will come. As Shankara says about, he uses the definition of dharma from Nyaya Vaisheshika school. The definition is yatho nishreyasaho, and some siddhi, which means dharma is that which will give you not only nishreyasa, but abhyudaya also. Abhyudaya and nishreyasa. Material welfare as well as spiritual welfare. But like the first category mentioned by B.P. Wadia, if we try to take only the material part of life, then he says that we are deluded, and in, like Krishna describes in the Gita, repeatedly we fall in the womb of error, and we take the downward path, which is very slippery. So that's the thing about wealth and right livelihood. There are a couple of other nice quotations that Wadiaji gives in his article. If we find time, we can take that. Or what is better is the audience can share online as well as offline their perspectives on this.
One point comes to mind. You were speaking of the karmic retributive effect that falls on the individual. Illegitimate means of livelihood, right? There's not only individual. Judge at Cosby, one of them, makes a very important point. He says that your family karma has been vitiated, right? And the souls coming into your family into such a vitiated condition would be contaminated.
Yeah.
And you attract to yourself souls of similar nature,
mm-hmm.
and the whole family karma degrades, and its effect on your nation, the whole nation degrades. So your ill effect of your illegitimacy is not confined to you or family. It gets diffused throughout and pulls the whole humanity down. So what the judge is saying is that you have unlimited responsibility. Your responsibility is unlimited, because your actions have either raises the quality of your family karma and heredity, or degrades it, and which have an impact on whole of humanity.
Very important. Thank you for bringing that up. Thank you.